Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Spacebar podcast. I'm John Woodall, CEO of Dark Matter Commerce, and on this week's episode, we're actually turning the tables, and I'm joined by Pete Robertshaw, who's head of consultancy at Space 48, and we're going to be talking about operational e-commerce and what it means. First of all, Pete, welcome to your own show.
This is weird, but yeah, hi.
Thanks for joining us, and also pleased to be asked to host this episode. So let's get straight into it. The first question is then, and it maybe it means different things to different people, but what is, in your opinion, operational e-commerce?
I guess, like I say, operational e-commerce means different things to different people, but I think I've come from a traditional operational e-commerce background, and by that I mean I used to get involved in all the kind of the non-sexy side things of e-commerce. Like, I've never been like a marketer. I was never, like, email marketing was never my thing, or acquisition strategy was never my thing. I was more like into the, how does an order get delivered to a customer? How can we quickly can we get it there? Have we got the right stock in the warehouse? Like, how do we integrate with our ERP system? And that was always my kind of thing I was really interested in. And when I came to space and started having sort of similar conversations with customers, and no one really was having those conversations internally. So like for me, operational commerce covers all the back office stuff. So like fulfillment and delivery, logistics, ERP, order management, payments, PIM, all the sort of stuff that sits behind the scenes of e-commerce, but is actually really important for driving retention, because I mean, we've had conversations about this, that if you haven't got the stock in the warehouse, or you deliver it late, or you've got a courier that chucks it over the fence, that's not a good customer experience.
Right, yeah.
And obviously, if you get that wrong, customers, you can have the best looking website in the world, that you can invest loads of money in CRO and making it look brilliant and all the UX you want, but then you might convert the customer once, but if you let them down because the delivery doesn't turn up or you haven't got the stock, then that's why, like, for me, operational e-commerce is really important, but it doesn't really get talked about enough. And often, like, the operational side gets shoved to the ops manager within their business, and there's no kind of tie-up between that and kind of the e-commerce manager. So, and it should do, because ultimately, e-commerce manager probably wants for delivering growth and retention, but if they're just focusing on, like, you know, customers visiting the site and making the site look great, but they're not concentrating on customer service being crap, then they're never going to drive retention. So, for me, that's the whole bit.
Yeah, agreed. I think the takeaway for me there, and what you how you introduced it, it's perceived to be the non-sexy side, but I challenge anyone with that, because, you know, show me a warehouse that's well organised, I'll show you a business and an e-commerce business that works well and makes money.
It's true.
And I actually think that when people talk about conversion rate optimization, in actual fact, you know, we can be fudging things around the PDP page, for example, but really what you're actually looking for is great customer experience, and you get great customer experience from all the things that you've just said, from, you know, the moment that it leaves the e-com website and goes to order management, let's say, all the way through to fulfillment, or even further on where someone's thrown something over a fence or delivered it in a really good way. That is fundamentally, you know, CX, that is customer experience. So there's obviously, when you start to think about what operational e-commerce is, then it goes all the way from, what I take is, it goes all the way from sort of order management, all the way through to when the item is delivered, and there's many bits in between, even demand planning, ERP, warehouse management, etc.
How do you
start to, knowing that that's then a big subject, we're talking about a really broad subject, how do you start to prioritize what all those different areas are? So when you go and meet with a client or a prospect, what are the key things that you look for, I guess, operational excellence in that e-commerce world?
I guess the first thing, the one place I always start with customers around that is, the key giveaways are where the potential challenge, or what they should potentially look at first, or the conversation they'll have, is driven by, if you go and look at any business's Trustpilot reviews or reviews, customer support reviews, like, that is gold dust in terms of where problems generally are. Now, sometimes you get businesses that are proactively looking at that and responding to reviews, but that uncovers so much in terms of, if your customers are saying that, on my delivery turn up, like, it's a common trend of deliveries not turning up, or the item's not the right quality, like, you know from your customers where the challenge is. If you literally listen to them and look at the customer service reviews, and listen, you might not have a full, like, you know, ticketing system for that can do data tracking analysis, but just go look at reviews. Literally, even if you don't sign up for like a review website like reviews.io or Trustpilot as a business account, customers will still go on there anyway and write reviews. So the data is there. If you dig into that data, it'll tell you, I guess, where your challenges often are. Now, for a lot of businesses, that these operational challenges we're talking about here, every business will have challenges to this, a lesser or more degree. If you're like a small startup that's, you know, maybe doing, you know, a couple million quid online, even less than that, you'll have certain challenges. But as you grow, those challenges become bigger, and what you need to do to solve them becomes potentially need more investment. So I also look at, I guess, how mature a business is, and, you know, you have like Rolls-Royce solutions for some of these challenges where you've got, maybe you need like an Audi A3 instead to fix them, depending on where you are in your business journey. So like for a lot of like startup businesses, they'll have like a lot of manual processes. They might be using like Excel to manage their stock, and that's where their warehouse management system is, their Excel. And it's just fine to a certain point. You know, as a startup business, you haven't got a huge amount of cash to invest in sort of really fancy systems, and you just use what you can and to get you by. So when I talk to businesses, it's like, okay, we recognize there might be a challenge there around, you know, their stock not being available in the right place, customers complaining that they're not getting deliveries on time. And it might just be like an evolution of a system or replacing some manual processes. It might just be moving Excel to a slightly different, more advanced system, but you're not going from Excel to like a full-blown ERP or SAP solution, like something like that. The steps you'll go on, and I think for me, the detail of any data you've got, dig into the detail of it. Like, you know, some customers will always say to me, like, you know, we need to invest in a new warehouse because we've outgrown ours, it's full. I'm like, actually, well, look in the warehouse, look at, have you got lines in there that aren't moving? You might have like really slow moving stock that's stuck on a shelf that doesn't move. Actually, you don't necessarily need a new warehouse. You just need to like have a better reporting system of slow moving stock and then find ways to kind of sell that stock through. So I always like to try and dig into the detail of customers and not make them think, oh, we need this new shiny new thing over here, this new system or new platform or new whatever it might be. It's actually, don't go that far yet. Look into actually where the actual problem is.
So what I'm hearing then is that it feels like you'll meet with people and they're already solutionizing first, and they're saying, oh, we're going to solve this with a new system for argument's sake.
Yeah.
But you're bringing it back to basics, and you're going in there doing research with tools that are free, or with research that's very freely available, being reviews.
Yeah.
You can look at someone's website. You don't necessarily need to go and speak to them to actually see that, providing they're publishing all the reviews. but I'm sure they're still collecting all the reviews.
Yeah.
So you can go and gather that information in that way. And I guess even just doing a walk around. But the message I'm getting here is it's all about taking it back to basics.
Yes.
Starting with the customer first, looking at, well, what do we actually need to solve here before you get to that point of going, what is the potential solution? Because then I think the second thing that I heard is, the solution that you present to the customer is going to depend upon their maturity as a business as well, on the complexities that they've got, and the solution that you end up recommending is going to be different depending on who you work with.
100%. And even like, I've worked with some large enterprise businesses that want to go like full blown. Maybe they've got, they're using e-commerce platform as like the water management system. So I'm like, oh, we need to go full blown NetSuite or whatever the name of your ERP solution. Actually, what's that actually going to solve? Why are you looking at that in the first place? And actually, maybe there's a more best of breed solution, which maybe it's around solving stock or inventory and think, oh, well, they can only solve that via ERP. And actually, there's other solutions out there that just do that job and do it really, really well. And they can carry on using the zero accounting software or whatever it might be, and then just integrate more of like a, I guess it sounds really obvious, what is the actual problem? What is the challenge they're trying to solve? And a lot of the time people chuck money at a solution when it's not necessarily the right one. And I see this quite a lot when I'm talking to businesses. Mm. And actually, some of the, there's a lot can be learned from some small startup businesses who are really basic, and they haven't got the, you know, the money to invest in a full blown system. So you have to find sort of better ways of doing things, or not stopgap solutions as such, but things that are fit for purpose.
Mm.
I often find as well, you get sort of both sort of techie people or IT people in businesses. I've been one, so I know you want to invest in the new shiny solution that's out there. You want to kind of have that as the technology. You get sold on it, but actually, if you take a step back and bring somebody in who can look at it independently, actually you can save yourself a hell of a lot of effort and time by just, again, focusing on what actually matters within a business.
Just picking up on something you said there of being the techie that was in the business, there'd be certain solutions, the big shiny, the new shiny thing, the new shiny toy to a certain extent. What other than that, where someone's going to actually really want to work with this tech, What other things trigger those conversations? So why else do you find yourself in that solution where you're the independent kind of going, well, do we really need to do this, you know, Rolls-Royce solution, when in actual fact we could get away with doing this and we'd actually get a better outcome?
A lot of it time is, it's funny, a lot of time you get conflict within a business. You get I'm going to work with a client at the moment who, on one side, you've got the IT guy who wants to invest in a new ERP solution, think ERP is the right thing to do. You've got somebody over here who's in the e-commerce side, think we know we need a new e-commerce platform. And I've gone in and say, well, what both of you can't be right. What's the actual biggest problem in the business right now? And if you actually listen to the right people in the business, again, look at the feedback. This customer does like NPS with their customers, a B2B business, and they actually ask the customers quite a lot in terms of what their the problems are. The actual problem is customer experience. The customer experience on the front end of the site is it's not great, and they openly admit that. And when did an ERP really ever really? ERP is it can help facilitate change, but actually, when you've got a customer experience problem, the customer doesn't care what ERP you've got. All they want to make sure is that their experience of A, ordering is right, and actually, then at the end of the day, gets them in the right way. So, in terms of why I often get brought in is where there's a bit of conflict. Thinking customers don't necessarily know what they don't know. There's a huge part of that, and again, it's assuming that there's a silver bullet out there or some magic solution that's going to solve things for. Actually, I've been in business before as well, where actually the tech isn't the problem, it's the process. And by just sitting down and observing the way people are doing things, change the process can actually really help as well. So I don't just go in, I love tech, I'm a big advocate of it, it can solve challenges, but actually there's no point investing in it where it's not needed. So again, a lot of time I'll go in and look at process. Given my operational background, that's where I guess people look to me independently and say, well, you know, look at this big picture. You're coming independently. How you can see, this is our opinion, but actually, what do you think is the right solution? I think I get, because I look at the whole end-to-end journey, I can kind of see probably where the actual pain points.
At a risk of answering my own question, how important, because you mentioned the process and the tech being closely linked to each other. I mentioned earlier, I asked a question about the maturity of a business. How important are the people, the teams and the skills that have people available? How important are they to the selection of, I mean, maybe recommendations that you might make?
Yeah.
How important is the team to that? Because I'm sort of thinking about customers I work with, projects that I've worked on myself, where some of my recommendations might well be based on actually this is the skill set of that team, and this is where I believe they're up to, or fundamentally are you actually looking at it as like proper change management, like you know, people changes as a result, because I think the system can probably only be so used so well depending on someone's skills.
It's true that, I mean, we often look at, when we do look at, we take it back to kind of e-commerce, the listeners to this will appreciate the commerce evaluations we do. So a lot of time we'll evaluate e-commerce platforms based on the skill set of the people that are going to be using it. It is the same with tech, because if you haven't got like a very heavy IT infrastructure in the business, go and recommend in some kind of like, again, huge ERP solution, that's got to be managed by somebody internally. You've obviously got to implement the whole thing. Like, if you haven't got a team to implement that, you're never going to get across the line. You can bring as many consultants outside as you want, but you've got to get the you know, a lot of time with these solution changes, it's people's time that are invested in this. It's like it involves a lot of stakeholders. So the people that are in the business definitely affect the recommendation you would make. Again, if you're a small startup, typically you'll have somebody doing it, like an e-commerce manager doing everything. Mm. They'll be both doing the growth role and the operational e-commerce role. And actually, sometimes, again, it's not necessarily about putting tech or systems in place. It can be about putting the right people. And this is I'm going to use your phrase, the right people, right place, right seats. Again, a lot of it is that maybe you haven't got the right people, the right knowledge within the business. It gets to a point, and I'm a huge advocate of this, that when business gets to a certain size, you can't have an e-commerce manager who's focused on like driving growth and acquisition and all that kind of, again, the front end stuff, also doing operational e-commerce. The two roles are completely different. Like I said before, I'm not a marketer at all. I was struggled with that side of the business. So I'd bring people in that were better at that than me, and then I would focus on the operational stuff. But then going back to your point about the systems and the tech, depending on who you've got in the business, no point in bringing in some kind of like fancy tech if no one's there, you haven't got the right skill set of the people to use it. And again, same with anything in e-commerce, it's any platform, whether it's email marketing platform, whether it's a search tool or whatever. if you haven't got the right people to manage it, it's just going to fall flat on its face. Again, that's maybe where more process comes in. But I do think you've got to have the right people in the right place to do the work. Again, systems can help, but if you haven't got the right people to manage them and utilise them, then yeah, it's, the tech's going to be a complete waste of time. And again, that's when the maturity of the business comes in again, because as a business generally grows, you've got layers, more and more layers of people. Like, you'll end up having a dedicated finance team and an ops team, etc. Then fine, bring in an ERP solution, because you've got a finance team that need to report on VAT and all that. But if you've got like four people in a business, you're never going to get to utilize those kind of functionalities of the system, for one. So it becomes like a waste of investment.
It's such a valuable piece of knowledge in there that you're sharing about. I mean, you can almost take a step back from e-commerce or operational e-commerce as well, and it's just about keeping teams nimble and agile. And I don't mean agile in a sense of, you know, agile methodologies. Yeah. I mean, just a team with agility. And I think some of my, I guess, obviously everyone's always got favourites, but favourite clients, prospects and clients that we speak to are actually those smaller, more agile teams, more nimble teams that can pivot and have actually got skills across different areas. Appreciate it just gets bigger and more complex as businesses grow. But there's a lot to be said for keeping things agile, I think. And technology choices coupled with that definitely help. So just sort of changing track slightly, because, again, I think there's some really valuable knowledge you've shared there. Can you share with us any other sort of key operational e-commerce challenges that you typically come across?
I think one that every business, I mean, all the things we talk about here, most businesses will have problems with, but one that you can't get away from, that every business I come across has challenges with, and you know this as well, is like that whole fulfillment, delivery piece, logistics, logistics. It affects businesses of every size. I think when you're a small business starting out, and we did some work with a client not so long ago, some consultancy work, they were that size where they were doing decent, they were doing okay volumes online, but they were losing money on every single delivery they sent out because they didn't have the buying power with like the parcel networks or whatever to kind of get their delivery rates lower. So when you're a small business, getting that delivery proposition right is really critical in terms of like how much you're charging. Now, I'm not saying as a retailer you want to go and try and make money on delivery, because there isn't any money in it. Even the carriers don't tend to make that much money. But if it's a small business, like setting delivery charges right at the right levels is challenging. Again, you're not the size to kind of get the right rates. There's ways around that. You can work with like parcel aggregators that can buy up volume and get you cheaper rates. But I often see customers at that size don't know what to do. Like, do we either make a loss on delivery? Do we put the delivery charge into our product costs, which means then actually, well, we're more expensive than somebody else? It is really challenging. Again, it's what I've often advised businesses, like, okay, well, you're not going to be able to compete with, you know, competitor Y over there, because you're not got the volume to keep your delivery costs low. But figure out what is your USP? Why will people potentially spend more money with you? What is, you know, maybe you're a small business, so you're going to give a better personalized experience, whatever it might be. So deliveries cost is a big problem at small businesses. When you get to a larger size, it's then you probably do more volume. Okay, well, then you need a bigger warehouse. Do you then have to deal with bigger SKU counts? Like, how do you manage that jump in terms of like volume? You know, you could have a 100,000 square foot warehouse and 50,000 SKUs, but actually you've still got John in the warehouse who's like knows where it's, everything's done on paper, he knows where it is in his head. That becomes a challenge for businesses. Again, it's scaling that operation. So fulfillment logistics is a common problem no matter what size of the business you're at. And I've started learning over the last sort of, even this, and I'm learning all the time as well. So the amount of business now that's starting to like outsource their fulfillment logistics to like a 3PL or or even starting to drop ship, because they just don't want that overhead of logistics. It is expensive. You know, I've learned from personal experience, investing in a big warehouse and not utilized properly can really cripple a business. Yep. So there's before you start diving in and saying, okay, well, we've got all this stock, this volume's massively increased, we need to get our own warehouse premises, look at what the other options are out there and cost it all up. Because we had James Hayes on a couple of weeks ago from Whistle on the podcast. He was talking about how loads of businesses overly invested in warehousing space, kind of just after COVID, riding that wave. Mm. And now they're sat with warehouses full of stock that really? They can't clear out. And it's like, you've got to try and be smart. But that again, when I talk to business, that whole getting delivery right, getting stock and warehousing right is a really tough challenge. And again, depending on how mature you are, the business model, the solution's not always obvious. And again, there isn't one solution that fits everybody. You know, some businesses do have their own warehousing. They can afford to, you know, the stock turns that high, they can afford to invest in it. But again, you've got to evaluate all the options and not just maybe led by somebody who's come in and not a smart manager who's been in some other business and done it their way before. You've got to take a step back of it and look, okay, well, again, what is the actual problem? Like I mentioned before about stock sitting on a warehouse shelf for ages, you probably don't need a new warehouse. You probably just need to do your stock churn better. Or, you know, if you've got a lot of returns coming back into the warehouse, why have you got returns coming back? Is it because the delivery's rubbish? Is it because the product's rubbish?
Interesting.
Is it because, again, if you look at the detail, a lot of returns are driven by people not having the sizing being wrong or the product information not being right. But actually, it's not because the product's crap, it's just the way you've described it. So then what's the solution to that? Well, it could be PIM or something like that. So again, there's so many things like factored in terms of like what can cause logistical problems.
So just linking this to something you said earlier then, you talked about reviews being a good place to sort of identify these challenges, let's say. I guess another good place to look that would be, it feels like it would link together all this quite nicely internally, would be like the customer service team.
Yes.
Is that an area where you, I'm answering my own question, you'd go and speak to the customer service team to find out, okay, so what problems have we got? You mentioned about returns. What do you typically find when you go and speak to people in the customer service team, and what does a link to that, what does a good customer service team look like? What information and insight can they give you?
Yeah, again, this goes back to this maturity of the business. It's like sometimes, again, you used to deal with small business where you've got actually the e-com managers also doing customer service. But again, obviously that's not sustainable. It's like grows. You might have some dedicated people doing it. Yeah, speaking to customers, actually not just customer service, sales people as well. A lot of the times the sales people can get it in the neck from customers because they've sold a product. So the customer service team and the sales people is quite an interesting way of getting feedback. The problem you've got is that, again, when you're a relatively immature business, even if you've got a customer services team in there, they're probably using like email, Outlook email for like customer service inquiries. So there's no like level reporting in there. There's no traceability. So if you ask me what a good customer service team looks like, it wouldn't be somebody using Outlook for email, because again, as you grow, it's just not sustainable. If you look at, again, the tech that's out there now, you know, I'm a huge techie, there's relatively low cost solutions out there that can help analyze customer service inquiries that come in. So, okay, you can ask a customer service agent, okay, what are the typical things you hear, and they'll probably reel off, you know, the top two, three things. But actually, if you invest in like a tool that helps your customer services team manage the inquiries, there's a lot of analysis you can do around the actual data, the actual real data that's coming in. So where, how many times is like poor product quality mentioned, you know, returns, like what? So a customer service person might say to you, well, our top number of inquiries is returns. We constantly have to deal with returns. Okay, well, why are the returns coming in? Okay, it's faulty product, or it's like the item's defected. Okay, well, is there any trend there? Is it one particular product causing that? Is there, most customer service agents probably wouldn't be able to give into that particular deal because they're dealing with so much, especially if you've got like a large catalogue. But where you've got, again, a platform that's from tech that can help you analyse that, you can very quickly see trends in data. So yeah, the customer service team can give you a good idea of some of the constant things they're hearing, but again, it's the detail. Mm. So is the your returns rate might be like, I don't know, so you've got a returns rate of like 25%, but it might only be a very specific amount of SKUs that are wrong. But again, a customer service agent probably won't be able to just specifically tell you. They'll just deal with the return and move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's that level of detail again, and again, you won't get that from just speaking to somebody.
Outlook.
Outlook's like, again, I'm a huge, I've, the amount of business I go into, and again, I asked them, how many email inquiries you deal with a day? Maybe 20 or 30. Again, well, do you actually know? But again, if you go to the worst one is where you see you've got two or three agents working on a single email inbox. Because like it just get like, how do you know who's dealt with what? Oh, we just mark it red or unread. I was like, well, how do you know you've dealt with it and you've got it? Okay. So again, I get it, people start out using Outlook for customer service, but it very quickly, that's one area of a business that as you grow, you're going to get more customer service issues generally. It goes hand in hand, right? But using Outlook for email is not the best way to do it. Again, even some of the customer service tools that exist out there, like I'm going to call them out, say Freshdesk or Zendesk or Gorgeous, a lot of those tools have got ways of helping customers actually self-serve their own problems. So actually, you're saving a load of customer service inquiries coming through the door anyway. Intelligent call routing, we put that in place when I was client side, and customer enters an order number in over the phone, and it can, the system knows where the order's up to. Oh, you've actually ordered that for delivery today, or it's coming tomorrow. It's like, I think a lot of businesses can actually help themselves a little bit and try and help customers self-serve as much as they can. So I know your original question was like, getting that information, going to your customer service team, is it a way to do it? Yeah, it is. I think you get a higher level overview, but I think unless you're quite mature and you've got that granular level reporting, the customer service team probably not able to give you the actual level of detail you need to make. Otherwise, you'll make the wrong decision. Because yeah. I think that's capturing data is one of the most important things you can do from day one. Even if you don't use it from day one, put something in place to start capturing data around, you know, capturing what the types of inquiries are getting, and you know, if it's faulty product, okay, what's exactly the fault we're getting? It's that kind of stuff. Again, the detail really matters.
Yeah, definitely. No, I get you on that. I suppose when you talk about data as well, you touched very briefly on product data before, product information management specifically, and I know this is an area that you've got a real passion for, and you've done quite a few projects for customers of Space 48 now. What kind of challenges do you come across when you first look at people's product data, and I guess other than the problem of it, you know, the state that it's in,
yeah,
what's the real implication in terms of customer experience or experience for the business?
There's a few things to answer there. I guess over the last sort of 6 to 12 months, I've started kind of like learning this term of like product experience. And the product experience you have on your site ultimately drives the customer experience, because if you're giving customers very basic product data, first of all, it's not going to help them make a purchase decision. They might end up going elsewhere to get the product information they want. So instantly, you've not given a customer experience because they've got to give bad one because they've gone elsewhere. So product information or product experience is fundamental to driving a great customer experience. And by product experience, I'm not just talking about having, you know, a specification sheet of product data on a page. You know, if you're selling TVs, for example, you sell an LG TV, for example, there'd be a dozen other retailers that sell that TV. The specs are going to be the same no matter what. And if you haven't got them, then you're doing something wrong because LG will give them to you. But it's what you, it's in how you enrich and enhance that data. A good example is, I've used this before on a podcast before, but you might sell, I've got an Apple MacBook Pro in front of me here. I might have on my website, I might be selling this MacBook Pro, I'll have the weight of like, I don't know, 15 kilograms or whatever. So what is 15 kilograms? If you tell me that there's a super lightweight laptop that when I'm traveling around is not going to hurt my back, like that to me as a customer, it's going to give me, make it my purchasing decision a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Like 15 kilograms, there's no context to it. So I'm giving you examples of great product experience here, but obviously some retailers who are doing get the basics right. They don't even have a product description. They've got everything's just embedded within a HTML page. And there's so many problems that you can't leverage the data anywhere else. You can't leverage it in search. You can't use like filters on the website to try and narrow down criteria. We work with some big businesses that are, you know, doing billions and billions of pounds of revenue, and yet the product pages are really poor. Like, well, how are they doing that? Most of it's offline revenue, to be fair. But like, if you just improve this data by putting some structure around a validation, you can use that data in so many ways. It's a common fact that poor product data drives returns. We know that there's a direct correlation between having like bad sizing or not enough information. You see businesses invest in PIM tools specifically to reduce return rates. If you used to write a business case for a lot of retailers, just the fact you can reduce returns by 2-3% by having better product data and structure is a key driver for it. I think the problem is if you don't structure your data well and haven't got a sort of central place to store it, trying to expand your business into other channels, like if you're going to try and sell on marketplaces or you're trying to distribute that data to other websites, for example, you end up just with data all over the place. It's no consistency. For me, like, again, we talk about having a great shiny website, great converts well, you've got a nice green add to basket button and it's been tested to the nth degree. But ultimately, if you're a customer on a website buying a product, the only way you're going to buy that is if you're convinced by the data that's there. Now, some products, maybe you need less sort of data. Maybe you're buying a dress, you kind of need to know what size it is. And, you know, are you bothered that it's midnight black? Maybe not. But if you're spending, you know, I don't know, £500-600 on an item, you want to be confident that it's going to fit your room or whatever. So the data's got to be spot on. So I guess the point is that, like, product information is so key to that. Yeah. Kind of experience as we're talking about. Okay, it's not we're talking about operational e-commerce, it's a tool that sits behind the sort of front end of the website, but obviously that is something that's directly affecting the front end. But again, you're never going to... The reason we talk about it operationally is because it can help reduce returns if you get it right. So many... I mean, I could talk about PIM all day, and it's a huge sort of thing I'm passionate about. But in terms of this context of operational e-commerce, if you've got poor product data, you might convert somebody, but they're just going to return in the product because you've not sold it properly.
I couldn't agree more. I think there's numerous clients that I've met with over the years, and when you ask questions about how that product data goes from, you know, the moment that they know that they're going to be selling that product to it appearing on the website, you might think there'd be some slick process that exists behind it, but I think of an example from probably just a matter of weeks ago where someone said to me, "Oh, it's, you know, such and such a body." In the customer service team or in an administration part of the business that actually inputs it all onto the website. I think in that particular meeting, we established that, you know, whoever this person's been doing it for 6 to 12 months as well. I think whoever's managed to do that job for 6 to 12 months has almost got a rite of passage. That's the way that they prove. That's the way that they prove that they've got some resiliency, because they've managed just to do product data input for X many months, which I can imagine being pretty soul destroying in some ways.
Yeah, it's funny. Do you know what? It's funny to talk about that, because one of the other reasons people look at PIM is because if you've got, I know that again, one of the businesses I worked with had a really high churn of staff in terms of the merchandising team, and they were using spreadsheets to manage the product data. The upload thing would constantly fail. The data wouldn't validate, and they kept bringing new people in, doing the same job again and again and again. And they were all, the common thing, the only reason they left was because of the systems they were using to manage product. It was horrible for them. So again, when we wrote the business case for this particular client as to why they should invest in PIM, stop staff turnover.
Yeah.
Because honestly, who wants to work on a spreadsheet day in, day out, keying in stuff, repeating tasks? It's just mind numbing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Give them a platform that actually can do a lot of the job for them, automate, and let them use the brains to kind of do the things like enriching the data and not, you know, having to repeat the same thing over and over, copy and paste. So again, in terms of justification for like PIM and operational e-commerce, staff retention's, you know, another one that can help. And it sounds weird, but honestly, genuinely, it can imagine if you're sat there all day, every day, filling a spreadsheet of thousands and thousands of lines of shit. It's just like...
100%, yeah. Yeah, this is the, you know, the obvious, we obviously look at it from a, you know, business perspective in terms of the user being the customer who's buying the product from the website, and that product data being, as you'd expect to find it, as you give the example of a 15-kilogram laptop, if that was pretty heavy as a laptop would go, to be fair. But I get what you were saying. But equally, the other side of it, you know, and you mentioned it, I said it before, but it's not my own saying, it's someone else's, but right people, right seats. But I think linked to that is right environment. And the environment fundamentally for a lot of people that are working on the product has got to be the business systems that they're using. And I think especially if you give techie people the wrong business system to work with, that would actually impact the churn of people that you've got. Just moving on from product data then, I think the other area that we perhaps not just touched on yet is payments specifically.
Okay.
Just wanted to get your thoughts on that, really. I think I'm assuming payments fits into operational e-commerce.
It does, very much so, because... Okay, again, although payments is something that sits on the front end of the website, and it's obviously, you know, customers can't check out without payments, it's not, again, the front end shiny piece. It's not having a new search provider, not having a really nice PDP. It's operationally getting payments right is important. There's a few reasons why. One of the biggest bugbears about payments and working with e-commerce businesses and retailers is, and I've been through this, is a finance team within a business will often dictate the payment provider you end up using, because they look at the bottom line. So you've got like a finance director or an accountant, head of account management, accountancy, whatever. They'll look at like, oh, well, this provider here, we're paying like 5p a transaction or whatever. You know, we're doing 100,000 transactions a year. Do the math. That's how much we pay. And the e-commerce manager comes to them and says, we want to move to this provider over here because it gives a better experience on the website. We can enable like Apple Pay and Google Pay or whatever it might be. And like, yeah, but their rates are like 20p a transaction. It's picking a percentage of my thing. Like, so they're going to shut it down straight away. The problem you've got is that you've got finance people making decisions over like the sort of the e-commerce experience. What they don't understand is the fact that actually the payment provider they're currently using their acceptance rates are through the floor because they don't. I'm going to say it's about acceptance rates, talking about, you know, for every 100 transactions that go through, if you've got an acceptance rate of like 70%, you know, three out of every 10 transactions are going to fail. Mm-hmm. And usually because we get it by because of fraud or whatever it might be. And actually some of the cheaper payment providers don't have the infrastructure and the data available to judge whether a transaction is fraudulent or not. So they just might reject it. So what ends up happening is you end up rejecting a load of decent transactions that you would otherwise accept. So in theory, your conversion rate on the site goes down because you're not converting those. But finance people will often just look at, okay, well, it's the cheapest provider, but they're not looking at... Yeah, exactly. So it's the rate. And it's like, it's not just that, but it's like trying to justify, like we've got customers at this day and age still use like, I'm not going to name the provider. I would normally do it, but I'm not going to do it today. That still use like a redirected checkout on the website. And it's just such a bad experience. But again, the finance team are saying, so, well, we get really cheap rates for those, we're going to stay with them. But they don't realise that what the actual, in terms of drop off a conversion, because people don't like being redirected, or there's such a clunky process. So I think when I go to a lot of businesses, one of the first things I'll look at is like who the payment provider is. Mm-hmm. If they're using a select few that I tend to stay away from, I'll go in and question why. Actually, a good example of this, I went into, again, one of our large customers that we work with. I was in the office one day working with them, was on something else, and I was just, one of the staff was sat behind me, and I turned around, I was like, I saw them in like the sort of payment admin panel. I was like, what are you doing? Oh, well, we're trying to figure out why we've got all these errors on the checkout, what's going on, we're trying to figure out why these payments keep getting rejected. And I was like, I can tell you why, because look at the logo in top left hand corner of that payment, that's because of the provider you're using. Inherently they have problems around the checkout. Funny enough, like sort of 3-4 months later, they've started doing a tender process to review the PSP. And actually, they've justified it to the finance team by looking at, here's all the evidence I've got of all these failed transactions. If we move to a provider that's actually got a proper integration and it's, you know, they've got better data, and like, it's just a no-brainer. So, I mean, yeah, obviously it has to be a business case, like it's difficult, but you can easily weigh up potential increases in sort of acceptance rates versus the lower payments you're going to provide. Now, a lot of people listen to this probably use on Shopify, maybe on Shopify Payments, and maybe you don't have a choice to go down that route. But actually, a lot of customers speak to like, oh, we don't want to move to Shopify Payments because it's so expensive compared to our existing provider. But again, look at the Shopify checkout. Look at, they've invested so much in that checkout, and there's a reason why, because their acceptance rates are high. The people get through the checkout really quick. Whereas if you want to use your existing provider because they're charging like 15p a transaction, like there's a reason why they charge that. That payments is, although it's not, I guess it is operational because it affects, you know, ultimately there's an element to it, but it is a front end issue as well. The other thing I would say as well, where it does affect financial teams positively, and this is a way, if I was an e-commerce manager, spin it to the finance team, is if you've got a payment provider, you've got your credit and debit card, you might have Klarna, you might have PayPal, they're all separate providers. Like, for a finance team to reconcile payments or payments with other providers, it's an absolute nightmare for them. And trust me, I've been there, I've worked with them. If you can say, look, we can replace these three different providers with one, you can reconcile it together, finance teams will buy into that because it's a headcount they can potentially repurpose elsewhere.
Yeah.
So that's another way operationally to think about sort of staff. And
yeah. I guess with some clients, depending, I'm just trying to imagine certain clients that we work with here, but certain pushback we might get for changing a provider online might be, oh, we're already using these guys in store, we've been using these guys in store for however long. That sometimes feels like a bit of pushback. So I suppose that leads me into one of my final questions, really. It's just that omnichannel experience. Does omnichannel sit as part of operational e-commerce?
Yeah, it has to. Omnichannel's... We did a podcast earlier on today about omnichannel, and it's difficult to get it right. Omnichannel brings more challenges with it. It's got its own challenges. So, like, for example, as soon as you start talking about omnichannel, and by omnichannel we're talking about, you know, in-store transactions and offline. You know, omnichannel brings with it things like click and collect. Customers expect, if you're a high street retailer, you can go and do click and collect. Click and collect, again, is really difficult to get right. If you approach it the right way, it's not difficult, but the things you've got to consider is getting the stuff delivered to the store when customers expect it. It's the whole communication piece around, when it's going to arrive in store. There's that whole buy online, pick up in store, which is slightly different, which is basically a reserve in store stock. I'm not a huge advocate of that. It causes too many problems. If you can get something delivered to from a central distribution center to your store, don't mess around trying to integrate store stock, because it again, the complete, you'll probably know this, but integrating if you've got like 50 stores, trying to service all that stock information on a site is very challenging. Again, you've got to have the right systems in place. The last thing you want to do is let a customer go and order something, assuming it's actually in stock. When they get there, it's not there. Like, it's just such a horrible experience. If you can facilitate click and collect, it's a much smoother experience. You've got more control. You're only having to manage one central stock pool, for example. But so omnichannel brings with it other challenges, like loyalty is a huge one, like trying to join up loyalty and gift cards. Again, operationally, trying to manage that and have manage it all in a central place is difficult. The one thing I will say about omnichannel is one of the common problems you've got is that you've got businesses, a lot of omnichannel retailers have got physical high street stores. They've had a point of sale system in that business for years. They've maybe got an ERP, which is, again, has been around since like the last 10 years. I was with a client yesterday who's got this really legacy EPOS, what do you want to call it, solution. They started out as a physical retailer first and then went online. So they've been around for years, the legacy brand, and they've been stuck with this EPOS, and now they're trying to do a whole omni-channel like loyalty and gift card because the customer's demanding it. And I'm like, I've gone in there like, and they're like, how do we integrate this really old scale solution to this modern tech, such as Shopify? And without, when I say ripping out the EPOS, which is, you know, be the easy selection, go and take your EPOS out, replace it with a Shopify point of sale, whatever. Actually, again, there's a significant level of investment there. The one thing to get right with, and the challenge around this is the integration piece. Mm-hmm. Omnichannel can be done right as long as you get the integrations done properly. Like, it's all about that, having that central pool of data and joining systems up. Even if you've got a legacy green screen system, it can still be possible to do integrations, but you need to work with some kind of ideal integration platform that can kind of manage that. Maybe it's worked with it before. Maybe you have to do some data translation. Maybe you're taking, I don't know, some CSV files out of your legacy green screen system and translating it and put it into some modern format for Shopify. So it can be done. We actually recommend a lot of iPasses, one specifically being Patchworks, we work quite closely with. That can take a lot of the headache away. And also, sort of trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
So again, we often say, I've been in businesses like, oh, we need to upgrade our ERP solution because we can't integrate with anything. Actually, it can be done, but it might not be as real time as you actually need it. So again, it's like going in and actually, again, understanding the challenge before you start chucking tech and solutions at it.
When people are looking at omnichannel, just sort of leading you with the question a little bit, but it always feels to me like when I sit down with a client and talk about omnichannel, they are trying to run before they can walk. In some sense, what I mean by that specifically is to your point about, well, we've got all this product in this shop here, but guess what? We've got 30 shops, and we want to sell all of that stuff on the web, and we're going to facilitate that through like click and collect, which is really hard to join together. I personally feel that the starting place for omnichannel should be, can I start with a single customer view? And is there a way of me getting there where perhaps I can, as a minimum from a reporting perspective, I can actually link together and say, okay, well, this is Pete Robertshaw. He's a customer of, you know, this particular e-com website. I know that Pete's buying behaviour is this, this, and this. He's bought this online and he's bought this in store, and he typically goes to that store. I think that quite a few businesses that I come across, if they could actually start with a single customer view in the first instance, because by the way, like you said, it's still not always that easy to get to that, because if you've got a legacy EPOS system in place and then you've got a Shopify store over here, for argument's sake, or whichever one it is, getting that information and data passing back and to, if you start thinking about either single customer view, so you can market effectively to those people, and you start dropping them into the right marketing funnels, be that email or wherever else. And linked to that then is loyalty. And if you've got that kind of reoccurring model where you've got loyalty, but I think there's different ways that can be solved. And I think a few people could take that advice on board and learn a lot from it, to start with a single customer view and build back up from there. Because if you actually started from that place, you'd have a much better idea of what you actually need to do in terms of product price and promotion and placement as well. Yeah. Which fundamentally is, that's the reason why these businesses do or they don't work.
I couldn't agree more with that. I think, again, the whole running before you can walk thing, I actually questioned it we did a podcast earlier on about omnichannel. I questioned, like, we had some specialists on who deal with omnichannel tech, and I was like, what, when you've got a customer coming to you and say, we want to do omnichannel, what do they actually want? What do they actually mean? do their customers actually want all of this kind of like joined up approach? Do they want to be like, you know, tracked online and offline? Do customers want this? Are you doing this because you feel like you have to do it? I agree with you, like starting from a point of understanding the customer and joining up that data, it's not easy, but it's a lot easier than trying to launch a full omni-channel loyalty gift card here. It's again, maybe progress to that point, but you can't do anything until you've got that, like you say, the single customer view. And again, there's systems and platforms out there can help that. And you don't need to invest in, like, I'm going to call out, I don't know, Microsoft Dynamics CRM, for example. You don't need to invest in a solution like that. There's other tools like Klaviyo or Metrio or something like that that can actually facilitate a bit of that and give you that view without going, we need a full CRM. What do you actually mean by a CRM? You understand your customer's transaction history, their preferences, etc. You can do all that in a lightweight, again, ESP, call it Klaviyo, whatever you want to go for. That's a really good starting point. And then, like I say, build, once you understand that, then look at how you can build out the other piece. And again, it's that maturity piece again. It's like, don't try and run before you. I've worked with some brands who, you know, I'm going to call relatively small Shopify merchants who want to do this whole piece, and actually, well, you're just not kind of there yet.
Yeah.
If you're going to do it, you've got to do it properly. Don't go half-assed.
Okay, Pete. So, look, we've covered an awful lot today, and hopefully what you've shared has been enlightening for our users, that we actually realise this, as you termed at the start, this unsexy subject is actually quite far-reaching and can have a real massive impact on the success or even the decline of a business. So really appreciate everything you've shared so far. I think you might have a little bit of a plug you want to put out there. Is there anything in particular you want to expand on that you spoke about today? Or do you want to share anything else?
I guess the most important thing for me, and it's funny that it really ties back to your principle of right people, right seats. And it, honestly, this, and before you even came up with this whole concept, you mentioned this a while ago, I'm a firm believer that you've got to have the right people operationally within a business that understand operations and e-commerce to a certain degree and work in a partnership. So, one of the big things is, if you're an e-commerce business and you're trying to grow and scale it, you've got to have somebody in the business that's not an e-commerce manager focused on acquisition and conversion rate. You've got to have somebody that understands the logistics side of the business, somebody that understands the systems and tech and understands operational. Now, that might be an ops director that just really gets digital commerce, but ideally you need to have, for me, somebody in that role. As you grow, get somebody in that role that's, you know, you've got an e-commerce manager over here that works an operational person, bring them together, because that's, for me, is a key success for a business. It's on somebody who understands both sides of it. You've got somebody over here driving growth, and you've got somebody over here making sure the stuff gets out the door. Again, you've got the sexy side and the non-sexy side. I don't know which category I fall into, or somewhere in the middle. But yeah, that for me is a really important point. There's so much that you can get, if you don't get it right, the business is never going to scale. In theory, actually, in fact, if you get it wrong, badly wrong, then the business probably won't be around. You know, if you're constantly getting returns, customer service is crap. Like, if you don't really focus on some of those things, your business isn't around. So the key point is focus on what your customers are saying. Listen, honestly, I know it's such an obvious thing to say, but if you're listening to a warehouse manager who says, oh, the warehouse is full, actually you might have bigger problems than that the customers are complaining about. So be careful what you look for and what you listen to, and basically look at what the data is basically saying. And that should drive what you focus on in terms of operational. The last thing I want to say was just from, again, a plug. So we are, I often find businesses struggle with all of this stuff, which is why we decided to Space for It and the Dark Matter Commerce to put an event on later this year, which is all completely focused around operational e-commerce challenges. So some things we've spoken about today, and there's a lot more, but it's like, customers, we're going to be speaking to customers who've actually been through some of these growth journeys and some things they've encountered along the way, whether it's like struggle with order management or payments or customer service or growing internationally. Like, all these things that businesses will go on, the challenges. We're going to be talking to customers about how they've solved that potentially with tech or process or whatever. So if you're an e-com manager or a CTO, if you're an ops director, if you're a finance, because finance people often get forgotten about, and you're having challenges, or you can see challenges on the horizon, this event we've got later in the year called Commerce Fusion is entirely focused around helping you understand those challenges and how you can navigate through that journey. Because again, believe it or not, every business will go through the same challenges ultimately. It just depends on what stage you're at and how big that challenge is. So yeah, this event we've got later in the year is going to be focused all around sort of challenging those. So if you hit us up at Space 48 or Google Commerce Fusion, then you'll be able to get some tickets to the event, and look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, I'm personally really excited about the event, Commerce Fusion. I think I'm in the privileged position of being just half a degree removed from AB, and hearing about what you're pulling together. And obviously, you know, we've spoke for 40 or 50 minutes today about this particular topic of operational e-commerce, but I'm sure we can fill out a day packed full of content that focuses on these areas. And I think what we're really talking about, from my perspective, I think when people talk about digital commerce transformation, I think this is really it. It's that intersection between business systems and people, and what fundamentally that leads to in terms of business success, that'll make it make or break a business. So yeah, look, thanks a lot for your time today, Pete. I really appreciate you coming on your own show, or at least giving me the opportunity to be the host for this one occasion. So thanks all to the listeners as well. Make sure you tune in next time for another episode of Spacebar Podcast.
If you're an e-commerce manager or work in the engine room of an e-commerce business, we've got an event dedicated for you. Taking place on the 20th of June at the Miniature Sound Nightclub in London, we bring to you Commerce Fusion, an event dedicated to solving operational e-commerce challenges. Hear from retailers who have solved the challenges around ERP, order management, customer service, fulfillment, product information management, international expansion, or marketplace expansion. This is an event led by retailers for retailers. Sign up today for free tickets at commercefusion.co.uk or search Commerce Fusion on LinkedIn. See you there.